Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio.
Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give it up for our one and only, you know him, you love him, Mr. Max Williams, our super producer.
What?
Woohoo!
So, yeah, they call me Ben. I am, as always, immensely privileged to hang out with Mr. Noel Brown, none other.
Wow. I get a mister? That's like an honorific. No, not really. I guess it would be. What is an honorific? Is that just like a funny title? Like Noel the Bold or Noel the Pedantic? Noel the Dull? That's more of an honorific. I think Mr. is just more of like a prefix.
Well, you know, to quote Quentin Tarantino in Pulp Fiction, we're Americans, baby. Our names don't mean beep.
Yes, that's true. And we're going to come back around to Mr. T. A little later in the episode today. And that episode is, in fact, part two of the tangled web of noggins that is phrenology, pseudoscience for the ages.
Yes, yes. It's high quackery here at Ridiculous History. And we are having such a great time. We were talking recently, folks, about the history of our show off air, Noel, Max, and yours truly. And we wanted to give some space real quick to super producer Max. Max, you had told us off air in preparation for part two of this episode that you had some stuff you wanted to air.
Yeah, I do. So I'm going to turn to the left here. It's going to be a very visual thing. It's going to be great for, you know, a podcast.
Great.
If
for
I scroll
audio.
Back, you guys will see there's no poster over there anymore. You guys see that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a map of the lands between?
No, from Skyrim's still there, but I took down the Fallout perk tree. That's because yesterday I got a new poster in. I was so inspired by the Nancy Wake episode that I got myself.
What?
Nancy.
A Nancy Wake film noir poster. It is from the artist. I found it on Redbubble, which is called the name of the website. It's the artist Tom Tom with the O's in that, spelled with a zero. It is amazing, and I love it, and I just wanted to give a little shout-out to that. Now I'm going to go put it back on my wall.
Classic internet artist name. The style is sort of almost like a cel-shading kind of video gamey look to a noir depiction of Nancy Wake, and she's wearing kind of a, not a fedora. What do you call that thing, Ben?
It's like a, well, it's definitely a hat. Max,
flat
could
cap.
You?
Yeah.
That's I'll bring it back.
Technical term. Yeah, hold it up again. Let's look at this hat. So it's almost like, oh, it's tough to tell because of the styling, but it's got a big brim. You know who would know? Noel, Holly Fry would know.
Ah, where's a holly fry when you need one?
I love our dudes, but initially it was, do they really not know what a beret is?
This is Holly Fry, one of the hosts of Stuff You Missed in History Class. Holly is a font of knowledge in many things, including hats. But when we talked, Holly seemed very puzzled by Ben and Noel's confusion.
Look, I get it. This is a stylized piece of art. But if you then look at any photographs of Nancy Wake on which this art is based, she is almost always wearing a beret. And she wears kind of a stiff beret that's like off to one side. But I really got confused when they mentioned the large brim. I don't know what they think a hat looks like.
Do you think there's really any hope for these guys on them ever figuring out what a hat is?
You know, I'm just going to go with my favorite response in such situations, which is, bless their hearts.
This sub-episode of Ridiculous History was written and produced by Max Williams, with special thanks to Holly Fry. Do you think Ben and Noel will learn what a beret is? Let us know on social media, and we will see you in the rest of this episode of Ridiculous History.
I mean, but it, to me, it appears less a fedora and more of a cabbie flat cap meets a beret. Anyway, the point is, she wears it well, and it goes along beautifully with her kind of beige. What would you call that? A duster, or sort of like a waistcoat? Not really a waistcoat, a trench jacket, trench coat.
Yes, there's some trenchery there. All hail the white mouse! It looks like almost like a summer hat with the brim turned up. Anyway, our point is, folks, we did a deep dive with our research associate Zach Williams into phrenology, and we knew going in this was going to be a two-parter. So if you have not heard part one, just pause, check it out. There's a lot of stuff that will apply. We'll give you a moment, maybe with a waiting room sound cue.
Slaps, you know, and the kids are repurposing it into this vaporwave stuff, I also love. It's good stuff.
Good stuff. Yeah, agreed. All right. So you've listened to part one. We're back with us. We've got the band back together for part two of Why Was Phrenology a Thing? In the first part of this series, Noel, you and I looked at the origin and the rise of phrenology. And Noel, I think you and I both were surprised by the at times really progressive stance phrenologists took, like the equality of the sexes. That's something I wasn't expecting.
Yeah, it's certainly a mixed bag in that respect, because some of the proponents of spreading the gospel, if you will, of phrenology certainly were trying to make it inclusive for both of the sexes. And there was sort of like a women's liberation kind of bent to it, ways of using phrenology to empower women and say, oh, women are actually good at this stuff. Though sometimes even those things were like, they're better at maths or like organization stuff that while seemingly progressive also kind of put them in a box as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But we were sort of inching towards, I think, where most of today's episode is going to focus, which is some of the really nefarious ways that that phrenology, somewhat similarly to the idea of like eugenics, were used, you know, to keep certain races down and certain types of individuals down because of perceived proof, you know, based on the shape and size of the parts of their brain, felt through the shape and size of the parts of their skulls.
Yeah. And in part one, you and I gave a shout out to Stuff They Don't Want You Know's episode on standardized testing, which has surprisingly similar roots. Yes. Yeah. Phrenology is not real science. It is definitely a study in contradiction. And we saved a particular bit of history that we thought would be illuminating for us to kick off part two of this series. And that is this. Yes, phrenology very much had a dark side, but it's a dark side that is older than phrenology. It's older than Dr. Franz Gall. You can trace the DNA of phrenology all the way back to another older pseudoscience, physiognomy. Physiognomy, right?
Yeah, that one has a similar ring to cranioscopy, but it's much, much older. Apparently, none other than Pythagoras, you know, the theorem guy, the triangle guy, was one of the early proponents of physiognomy. He would often physiognomize the young men who surrounded him and who he was, you know, mentoring and acting as their tutor or instructor. And this is according to the Roman historian Aulus Gellius. And by the way, a lot of the stuff here that we're about to cover in this section comes from a fantastic Wired article by Matt Simon from January 21st of 2015. Not going to read the headline because it gives away some of the fun stuff to come, but definitely worth a full read. And also the work of Matt Simon in general is quite solid.
Agreed. Agreed. So say we all. I love that you're bringing up Pythagoras because this idea of seeing people who want to be his students, literally seeing them. And then, let's see, Gellius says that Pythagoras inquired, quote, into the character and dispositions of men by an inference drawn from their facial appearance and expression and from the form and bearing of their whole body. To me, that sounds like either a casting couch, I know we're a family show, or a vibe check. Like what
you say, we're a family show, but we just did that Dr. Finger joke in the first part.
Yeah, baby.
Well, I probably broke my finger as a result of bad karma for that one. For anyone who, obviously, we're an audio show. We just described a poster to you. I am recording this episode with a weirdly bent left ring finger, and our own Mr. Noel Brown is a trooper because this man is recording while moving houses.
That's from the, what did I describe it as? Like sort of a vacant white void, sort of like where John Oliver broadcast from during the pandemic. I'm just in, you know, it's my same studio that I've been in for years now, but devoid of all stuff except for my little desk and my USB mic, because I'm still waiting on internet to be hooked up in my new place, but that should be any day now. Ben, would you consider your finger, is it sort of a furled finger? Shout out to Elden Ring content.
Oh God, not Elden Ring again, guys.
I almost want to take my homemade splint off so you can see the offensive geometry of my finger right now. But what we're seeing is we're going to power through because we are so fast.
Speaking of offensive geometry, let's go back to Pythagoras.
Yeah, there we go. Like he's just like, imagine you're like, here is one of the great thinkers of my time. Please, Pythagoras, teach me your wisdom. And he's like, stand back. Let me check what you look like, because the idea, and we learned this thanks to Jody Jenkinson in a wonderful essay called Face Facts, A History of Physiognomy from Ancient Mesopotamia to the End of the 19th Century. The idea here that Pythagoras is practicing is that if you look like a certain animal, then you have that animal's personality and characteristics and attributes as determined by the observer. Like, have you ever met someone and thought, if you were an animal, you would be this animal?
Sure. Maybe someone with sort of lupine features. There's actually a fabulous illustration in that Wired article that I mentioned of a gentleman with sort of a broad skull and a sloping pointy nose and a very small kind of chin and mouth area posed next to an illustration of what looks to be kind of a bloodhound. And the delightful caption from Matt Simon, or whomever writes captions for Wired, says, according to the theory of physiognomy, the man pictured would behave like a dog because he looks like one. Right. Kind of like Teen Wolf, only without the sick Ray-Bans. Remember, that was back when Ray-Bans were like affordable. You could get them anywhere. And then all of a sudden, like Luxottica bought them, and then they became this like bespoke item.
Yeah, they're all made by Luxottica. All the sunglasses. Check out our episode on that. Also, I want to shout out, I love the English language, man. I want to shout out another great word, vulpine, V-U-L-P-I-N-E. If you hear someone described as having a vulpine face, it means they look kind of like a fox. So,
like the Pokemon Vulpix, if I'm not mistaken, is a fox-like Pokemon.
That is correct. It evolves into Ninetales.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
Match with the facts.
Yes, do it.
They're still facts, even if they're tangents. It's totally factual.
It's totally.
People
it's
need
totally
to know play. About the evolution of Pokemon.
And I'm not going to talk about anything after second generation because I do not know all 9 billion Pokemon that they have now.
That's where you draw the line, Max.
Yeah, second generation. That's when I cut off. Second generation is the last time you could catch them all in one game. Well, correction, you needed the past generation, but you could actually catch them all. It was actually feasible. After that, no, doesn't count.
I respect. Wait
a minute, are you saying catching all the Pokemon is a fool's errand at this point? It's not possible? Is that what you're saying? Yeah.
And I think by the third generation, you couldn't catch like Charmanders and Pikachus and stuff like that anymore. I never played them. But second gen's where it's at.
I respect you,
Max. I know the 250.
A man's got to have a code. And shout out to our ride or die, Mr. Matt Frederick, for the amazing performance in one of our favorite sound cues. So we know basically that this is judging people's appearance, right? With all the confidence of the very incorrect. And it almost becomes a medical diagnostic. Like you could look at someone and say, hey, you are obviously ill, or you are given to being profligate or something like that. This practice from the age of Pythagoras continues sporadically throughout Europe in the Middle Ages. And in the 16th century, it has what PR folks will call a moment. It really, like, it goes nuts. People are all about it. And a lot of this is due to an Italian guy, Gian Battista della Porta, who legitimizes this study of physiognomy as what he calls the product of natural science. He writes a book called De Humana Physiognomonia. And he has a lot of, I think his illustration is the one that's in that Wired article, Noel, right? It's like a lot of illustrations of human beings next to animals that he thinks they look like. Obviously, he's got his thumb on the scale because he's drawing both of these illustrations. And then he kind of makes them caricatures. These are not photorealistic drawings of people.
And, you know, much like where we have landed with phrenology, physiognomy was also pretty fully discredited by the end of the 17th century. But of course, there are those who continue to grasp on to the past and say, no, everyone else is wrong. I know what's going on here. So in the 18th century, you had a guy named Johann Caspar Lavater, who was an evangelist kind of for physiognomy. He actually published a four edition treatise, or I guess more than a treatise. I mean, it's really like a tome, a volume tome on the subject, saying, quote, again, from this Wired article, one could better love one's neighbor by classifying him according to his facial features. Okay. Is that really what you're after? To love one's neighbor by pigeonholing them because they look like a pigeon? Perhaps? I don't know.
There we go. Yeah. I know we got a lot of tangents here, but let me go on a tangent real quick. Let me set up a soapbox. Noel, Max, fellow ridiculous historians, I have always objected to the old idiom in English, you can't judge a book by its cover. Because What do you see at bookstores? What do you see at libraries? You see books with covers. There's a reason those covers exist. And maybe it's a little personal at this point. Maybe it's a little close because we just wrote a book that's coming out in October for Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. But anyway, yeah, absolutely correct. This guy, Lavatar, is saying it's good to look at people's faces and draw your own conclusions. He thought that the more attractive a person was, again, in his estimation, the more moral, the more ethically sound, the better they were. And there's a really cool example that Matt Simon uses by way of comparison, like palmistry. He's applying the assumptions of reading palms to the assumption of reading faces.
I've always kind of felt there was a kinship between palmistry and phrenology. You know, palmistry is less about othering and kind of like, you know, figuring out how people's brains work. It's more about like divining future events, you know, based on like the layout and the lines and all that of people's palms. So a little more tied to like, you know, astrology or spiritualism and stuff like that. But I've always kind of felt like there was sort of a kinship there. I think it's interesting how even to this day, there are like kind of echoes of these things in terms of like, they say that people with beards are less trustworthy or people perceive them that way, or like clean shaven people are more trustworthy. And then of course there are much more racially motivated in a negative way. I'm not sure what other way there is, ways of examining people's faces and noses and saying, oh, if you got a nose that looks like this, you must be from this particular ethnic group and all of that stuff. So there certainly are kind of like remnants of this kind of thinking still active to this day.
Absolutely. And let's give a very dubious shout out to another character in this conversation, Cesar Lombroso.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos, and the last one, God bless it, I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now.
Oh, man. And funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth. And while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This episode of Ridiculous History is brought to you by Mint Mobile.
If we've learned anything in the process of doing this podcast, just living life, it's that there's always a catch.
So when we heard that for a limited time, all Mint Mobile wireless plans are $15 a month if you get a three-month plan, we looked at each other and we thought, what's the catch?
But here's the thing. In this case, there isn't one. Mint Mobile's secret sauce is that they sell wireless service online.
Yeah, they cut out that middleman cost of retail stores and they pass those sweet, sweet savings directly to you. We're not joking. We have tried out Mint Mobile ourselves and it's super convenient. And it actually, like, we tried to find a catch and there's not one.
So to get this new customer offer and your new three-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
That's mintmobile.com/ridiculous. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/ridiculous.
$45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first three-month plan only. Speeds slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan.
Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. This guy, Lombroso, is convinced that you can look at someone's face, regardless of their age, and tell if they are a criminal, if they are destined to be a criminal. And this is something that you and Max and I were joking about off air. This guy's doing something that a lot of scientists were doing in this age. He was grading facial features, and somehow, every time, he found a positive attribute. It happened to be correlating with one of his own facial features. And every time there was a negative attribute, it was a facial feature that he himself did not possess. So if he had a small nose, he would say big noses mean you are, you know, like given to gambling. If he had a weak chin, he would be like prognathic chins are, you know, those are for adulterers. It's not super sound methodology is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I want to pop back to something I said in the last episode where I made a blind stab in the dark about the origins of the expression cut of your jib.
Or ooh, I've got this jib. One too. Yeah.
I've got it too, but I totally got it wrong. In my mind, I'm like, jib, you know, usually refers to like liking the way someone looks or like the cut of their face or their bone structure.
It's sailing.
That's not what it is at all. Yeah, it's a sea, a naval term. A jib, of course, being like the sail or the mast, I believe, or part of a warship. And the term was used, I believe, popularized by Sir Walter Raleigh. And the idea of liking the cut of someone's jib referred to being able to identify the nationality of the ship based on the shape of their jib before you could actually see the flag they were flying. So just wanted to drop that out there, correct my past self, and now we can move on. But
oh, it's yeah. Awesome. I'm really glad you brought this up because this stayed with me, and I want to give a shout out to one of the friends of the show on Instagram who actually asked me, Noel, to talk about this etymology. You're 100% right. The jib is a triangular sail that is between the fore topmast head and what's called the jib boom. So it's a weird triangle in the front of the ship for sailing, and some have more than one jib. But like you said, every country had its own style of jib. And so you could see a ship and say, well, that's a Spanish ship or that's a Portuguese ship. It didn't become an idiom the way we use it today until 1824 when Sir Walter Scott said
Scott, not Raleigh. Thank you. Thank you, Ben.
Well, we got our Walters.
We got our Walters. So, there's a lot of Walters to keep track of in history. So
in St. Ronan's Well, this guy, Walter, says, quote, if she disliked what the sailor calls the cut of their jib, and then later it becomes kind of phrenological, right? Kind of physiognomic. The idea that you could perceive something inborn about a person or an object based entirely on its appearance. So I would say, dude, this is the perfect time. This isn't even a tangent. Cut of your jib. We explained it. We gotta
do another idiomatic for the people episode. I think this would have been a real good one for that.
I love that series.
Put a pin in that for now. Yeah. I think we're due another one. But Lombroso, much to your point, Ben, similarly to the way a psychic might rely on reading someone's palm and the layout of the lines and all of that to determine some future event or some, you know, prognosis about love or whatever it might be. This gentleman believed he could tell whether someone was destined for a particular lifestyle, for example, a life of crime, based on the shape and arrangement of their facial features.
Yeah. He also said that criminals, again, as classified by him, were atavistic, meaning they were evolutionary throwbacks. He believed that criminals were closer to apes than they were to human beings. And by apes, we mean like gorillas, because technically all of those are primates. He would also talk at length, because he was an avowed enthusiastic racist, he would also talk at length about quote unquote savages. And he thought anybody with the following features, and we'll read them out to you, was given to being uncivilized, barbaric, and criminal. He talked about oblique eyelids, which he called a Mongolian characteristic.
He also referred to the projection of the lower face and jaws, something he classified as prognathism, which he associated with people of African descent.
Yeah. And then he also had a lot of trash to talk about noses. Spoiler alert, folks. Noses that look like his are the best. And noses that don't look like his are the worst.
He specifically was pretty focused on nostril size.
Right.
The idea of the larger the nostrils, the more inclined to raping and pillaging you might be.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, thank goodness he didn't steer history too far askew and that his ideas were later debunked. So physiognomy, surprisingly, came very close to changing the course of science and research in human history. Charles Darwin almost, this is a true story, Charles Darwin, yes, that Charles, almost did not hop on the HMS Beagle, which meant he almost didn't write about evolution, because the captain of the Beagle, a guy named Robert Fitzroy, was a fan of this learning about people via their facial features thing, this whole debacle. And he loved Lavater. And when he first met Charles Darwin, Captain Fitzroy was like, I don't like your nose, though. You kind of got a criminal nose, bro. I don't know if I want you on the ship.
Follow your nose right off this vessel, sir. He believed that the shape of Darwin's nose inclined him to be less resilient on a long sea journey.
Yeah. He was like, you got a low energy nose, my guy.
And the way that Darwin put it was, but I think he was afterwards well satisfied that my nose had spoken falsely.
Beautiful. And also shout out to our pal, Jack O'Brien of Daily Zeitgeist. We always have him and Miles Gray over to talk about weird historical flexes. Jack is the guy who told us that Darwin prided himself on eating a sample of every animal he discovered.
He was a hungry boy.
He's a hungry, hungry hippo. So we've got this set up. We know now that phrenology is descended from older, equally flawed attempts at science. We teased this in part one, and we wanted to give everybody a heads up, because this is uncomfortable for many people, but it's true. Phrenology was used to justify some unclean, absolutely unforgivable stereotypes. And a lot of it again, phrenology reached its heyday in the United States, a lot of the conversation around phrenology was used to perpetuate slavery. It was used to combat abolition.
Which is interesting because you also mentioned in the last episode, Ben, that it took off so well in America because of our kind of attitude of like self-determination and like being able to kind of like, you know, become our best selves in the new world or whatever. And it was used to kind of bolster those kind of feelings of like, you know, empowerment for the individual. But it was also used to completely disempower, disenfranchise, and in fact, enslave, or at the very least, you know, give a pseudo-scientific justification for enslaving other, you know, people.
Yeah, including indigenous populations, including the actual Americans who were here long before the Europeans. So the U.S. as an institution in the 1830s and 1840s, during the height of phrenology, this institution was trying to justify the continuation of slavery. Although many, many people were saying, hey, every human being should be treated equally, right? Didn't we have a whole thing about the pursuit of happiness? Several people said, and several pro-slavery forces said, it's paperwork, don't sweat it. Let's introduce, and I want a really nasty sound cue for this guy because I don't respect him. Let's introduce Charles Caldwell. There it is. Double thumbs down from Mr. Max Williams.
Boo.
Boo. Charles Caldwell was a key player in this pro-slavery movement. He used phrenology as a way to justify enslavement of human beings. And he said that people from the African diaspora, no matter, you know, which specific part of that huge continent. Details aside, he said anybody who is somehow descended from the African continent had to be enslaved because, he said, I've looked at a bunch of skulls. I've rubbed a bunch of bumps on a bunch of craniums, and I went to Paris to do it, so believe me.
I went to Paris and studied the Musée de Phrenologie. I mean, come on. I know. I'm the guy you should listen to. And it was one of those confirmation bias things where it was exactly the data or the pseudo data or whatever you want to call it that folks needed to justify their behavior. So in 1837, he put out a conclusion stating that skulls of African people, again, which is in and of itself an incredibly generalized view of a massive, very diverse and rich culture of people, that the skull shape, based on the study of phrenology, belied a certain tameableness, a certain need to be subjugated, a certain passiveness that really wanted to be exploited. Like not exploited. Like it was like, this is what they want. This is what they're made for. The people in question here, which again, incredibly narrow view. It's absurd, first of all, and it's completely self-serving to those who would have loved to continue to own and exploit slaves for their own purposes for as long as humanly possible.
Yep, absolutely. And this, unfortunately, added fuel to the fire of the pro-slavery institutions, and it gave slave owners and supporters of chattel slavery, it gave them something that appeared to them very much like quantitative ammo. They felt like they could point to this and say, oh, it's not me. These are just the facts, you know? And it's a very dangerous thing. You're probably wondering at this point how phrenology was applied to Native American populations. Well, we have more bad news for you. There's a guy named Samuel Morton and several other people, this was a movement, who used phrenology to justify things like the Trail of Tears, to justify removing these communities from the land they had lived on for thousands of years. No, I'm thinking specifically about a book called Crania Americana, which Morton wrote in 1839. And I want to give a big shout out to Kay Tatowski, who over at Vassar wrote Phrenology and Scientific Racism in the 19th Century. Tatowski gives us a very somber view of Morton's actions.
A lot of good articles over there on that blog for the archaeology department over at Vassar. Highly recommend giving that a browse, some good rabbit holes to fall into. But yeah, this was all a way of using quote-unquote science to determine that another race was inferior.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he said there are natural differences. In his mind, there were four quote-unquote separate species. And he was like rubbing up a bunch of skulls, right? And then he said, based on my vibes, because vibes they were, this was not objective.
Oh, yeah.
He said, the minds of the Native American populations are different than that of the white man. And he got cited in so much propaganda because there were Western settlers, right? Making their way toward what we call California and the Pacific Northwest today, and they wanted to hear good things about themselves. So they would read this and they would say, oh, it's not me. It's the science.
Yeah, he referred to these people, the Native American people, as being, quote, adverse to cultivation and slow in acquiring knowledge. So just basically completely character assassinating them in just about every way.
Yeah, I like that phrase, character assassination. Yeah. Another fan of Morton's work, President Andrew Jackson.
Oh, that ass.
Yeah. So, phrenology, that's the dark side. It did a lot of bad stuff and it supported a lot of evil actions by people against other people. But we do have to recognize that this is one of the earlier trains of thought that led to some actual breakthroughs. The recognition that different parts of the brain have different functions.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by eBay Motors. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Noel, do you remember your favorite car?
Well, yeah. It was an Eddie Bauer edition Ford Explorer.
Oh, that's and cool.
I just remember it was my dad's. I was a hand-me-down car kind of kid. Dad would buy a new car. I'd get that car. And I just remember feeling so awesome being up above everybody. Like I was in Mad Max or something, you know?
I had a lot of land yachts that I loved. I had Pontiac Bonnevilles.
Right.
Oh, I never had an El Camino. My dad had one. And that was a real interesting use of our collective time, keeping that thing running. But I think these cars all kind of speak to us because they were such a fundamental part of our lives. Do you remember when I had that Monte Carlo?
That's what I meant. I said El Camino and I meant Monte Carlo.
I miss it. So the Monte Carlo was tough. I had a series of Monte Carlos and the last one, God bless it. I had to learn a lot about car maintenance just to keep that guy running.
Totally.
But it still was like a perfect fit. It's almost like finding your true love. You know, like when you recently got a car a few years back now,
Oh, man, and funny you should say that. That particular perfect fit was the Honda Fit, which I love dearly. But, Ben, it's getting a little long in the tooth, and while it's been incredibly reliable up to now, it's getting to that age where I might have to start looking for some parts here and there to keep it running.
Mm-hmm. And that's where eBay Motors comes in. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly.
Brake kits, LED headlights, roof racks, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it.
And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back.
Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash.
So keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com.
Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. And this is really exciting to me, Noel. I mean, of course, phrenologists didn't ever figure out what those actual functions were, but the concept that different parts of your brain can do different things, pretty amazing.
Yeah, and like accurate, you know, in the same way we were talking about, there were parts of the groundwork for phrenology that weren't like that far off. It was just kind of taking something that ended up being true to an illogical conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, now we know that different regions of the brain control things like motor skills or language or perception, right? And there's, you know, was it proprioception, the sense of one's mm-hmm. body in space?
I think that's right.
Yeah, like that's kind of the root of a lot of modern day science. We call it neuroscience. And that's where we take the final act of phrenology here. Contemporary neuroscience continues to kind of wrestle with some of the accidental progress made by phrenology. You know what it reminds me of? I was thinking about this. I didn't want to tell you till we were on air, but like alchemy, right? Alchemy, a bunch of people who thought they were learning magic, right? They thought they were doing sorcery, and then they accidentally became the predecessor of chemistry.
I mean, isn't that how it goes? You know, I mean, it's this, you know, trial and error, thinking you're pursuing one thing and then happy accidents lead to another discipline entirely. We see that in technology. We see that in, you know, innovations of all kinds. Even if the original thing is entirely kind of gross or bad, it doesn't mean that it can't lead to interesting discoveries that can then be used in positive ways down the line.
Yeah. And this is pretty interesting. There's a guy who has now appeared across several of our shows, Noel, the Harvard psychologist, Professor Edwin G. Boring. We mentioned him in standardized testing as well. So old Doc Boring, in 1929, he writes a book called History of Experimental Psychology. And he says, quote, "It is almost correct to say that scientific psychology was born of phrenology, out of wedlock with science." I think that's so poetic.
100%. The idea of being born out of wedlock is usually considered kind of like a bad thing, or in some way unnatural, or like the idea of being a bastard or whatever. You know, that's a negative term, being unholy or something. But it doesn't mean that that person can't go on to do great things.
Yeah. And it all goes back to this understanding that physiological characteristics of the brain can influence behavior, and that behavior can alter our physiology. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, the best examples of mind over matter that I have ever encountered have been London taxi drivers who take a test called the Knowledge, which, you know, doesn't allow them to use any sort of GPS or any sort of maps. They have to keep it in their head. And over time, over decades, the physical structure of their brain changes. You can also see this with certain monastic orders. Your thought can alter parts of your brain. And the principle is the same. The idea that the mind is not a uniform thing, but more kind of a mixtape of these independent, wait for it, faculties. Dr. Gall loved calling stuff faculties.
Yeah, for example, like in 1861, a French surgeon named Paul Broca, who's also an anthropologist, demonstrated that by damaging a particular region of the brain, just about 4 square centimeters large, it can actually make a person unable to speak coherently, but it doesn't affect their comprehension of other people's speech. It's the same way, like, you know, if you have like a stroke, for example, it can affect your ability to speak, but it doesn't mean that you can't completely understand what others are saying. Like, I think of the character in Breaking Bad, Hector Salamanca, who, this isn't a spoiler because you meet him at the beginning and he's already like this. He has some sort of event that leads him, leaves him somewhat paralyzed, and also lacking the ability to speak, but he clearly can understand everything that everyone is saying to him and can communicate with a series of bell dings.
Ding, little, ding, ding.
Little,
he's got the like De Niro face.
Lobby too. Bell that's sort of like wrapped around his wheelchair. And he can also do the thing where he points to letter, or he, you know, does a series of beeps depending on what letter someone's pointing to, and he can communicate perfectly well. Another example of this in history is the story of a New England railroad worker named Phineas Gage. Mm-hmm. There is, in fact, a full episode about this on our sister podcast, Stuff You Miss in History Class, who in 1848 got an iron bar, like Final Destination style, just rocketed into his head. And it pierced his brain, like right through his cheekbone, exited through the top of his skull. Not only did he live, but his sense of reasoning and language were completely intact. But it did change kind of his tude.
It turned him to a pill. It's a true story. I have been fascinated with this. I'm so glad we're mentioning it. Before his injury, Phineas was an all-around like swell dude. You know, you could kick it, you could hang with him. He was genteel, he was amicable. But afterwards, this guy was like always down to fight. He was full of vices. He was super irresponsible and flaky. He started cursing like a sailor, as the idiom goes. And his behavior was so dangerous that women in the area were warned not to be around him. Basically, calling back to our etymology reference, that iron bar changed the cut of his jib in a very real big way. Time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And this guy named Antonio Damasio, who's a neuroscientist at the University of Iowa College of Medicine, actually studied the Gage case. Damasio and his wife, who's also a neuroscientist, recently created a 3D image of Gage's injury and, you know, kind of mapped the bar's path through his brain, and they found that it had damaged the same region of his brain that had been injured in patients of theirs who had very, very similar results.
Yep. And fun callback here, in 1848, a lot of people came to examine the case of Phineas Gage. And one of those people was a phrenology expert, a disciple of the Fowlers called Nelson Sizer.
And Damasio actually had some pretty interesting things to say about what parts of, you know, the inner workings of the brain phrenologists got right. He had this to say in an article from Smithsonian Mag called Facing a Bumpy History about Phrenology. He said that the work of phrenologists was, in fact, quote, quite astounding for their time, but that they, quote, did not understand that even the areas we have identified, quite different from their organs, are interdependent parts of a larger brain system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are, it's almost like fingers on a hand, right? Like your fingers can move independently, but they're all part of a larger superstructure. And, you know, it's pretty amazing that people could come up with these concepts. It's also very disappointing that they misdirected these innovations.
Totally.
Yeah.
For a long time.
Oh,
you could argue again. And I think I kind of harped on this in the last episode. By sheer force of will and enthusiasm and confidence, they probably set back the course of science quite a few clicks.
I was thinking about this as well, man. The meditation for the day for me after we finished part one was, may I always have the strident confidence of the aggressively wrong.
Yes. to espouse my crackpot theories, even if I'm not quite sure they're true.
Right. Let me turn my correctness down to 1 and my confidence up to a 12. This science continues, though. Science that is in some ways precedented by phrenology. There was a recent study at the University of Oxford where researchers use their own brain scanning software to ask empirically for the first time ever whether there is truly any correlation between the bumps on your head and the aspects of your personality, between the outside of this car you call your body and the interior engine of your mind. And this is pretty interesting. I think this is something people are waiting for. They used MRI brain analysis?
Yeah, they used the kind of software that does brain analyses of MRI data. And the software would typically be used to kind of do a cross-section of the parts of the skull, allowing analysis to be done on just the brain. But what they did was they kind of reverse engineered the software, at least reversed its instructions, to allow the skull to exclusively be mapped and dissected electronically.
Yeah. And what they found, of course, proves that phrenology is a pseudoscience. It's quackery of the highest order. But they did find some pretty funny associations. When they were looking at these brain bumps, as you said, hacking their software, they said there was a strong positive association between the trait amativeness, the arousal or feeling of sexual desire, and words. This means that, and again, take this as it is. This is just one study, folks, but we thought this was delightful and very funny. What they found in plain English is that the more sexual partners a person has had, the more likely they are to have verbal fluency in a word naming task.
Fascinating.
Weird. They're just throwing bombs.
This topic just kind of keeps on going. I propose, Ben, there's some stuff in here that I don't think we're going to get to, but I do propose that we end, or at least come close to ending, inch towards wrapping up, with something that we sort of teased at the beginning of the episode. We promised we were going to get back to Mr. T, and that's T for Tarantino. Mm-hmm. You may recall we spoke, I believe we all gave him thumbs downs and boos, Mr. Caldwell, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Charles Caldwell?
Yeah, we're going to Django, aren't we?
I'm going to Django. Charles Caldwell was a doctor from Kentucky who was a big fan of slave ownership and a big fan of phrenology and was a big reason, or he was the person that traveled to Paris and all that stuff to kind of, you know, bring that medical fad to the masses here in the United States in an effort to justify the barbaric practice of slave ownership. And you'll recall the character of Calvin Candy. You may know from the memes. He's the one that's got his pinky up and making that little face, you know, Leonardo DiCaprio. I actually saw a funny thing that Miles of Daily Zeitgeist pointed out where it was like an image of a poster you could buy that's just that image. Mm-hmm. And he argued that that image devoid of meme text is really just an image of an excited slave owner. He's probably just talking about slave stuff. But you'll recall that character in the movie, he breaks out a skull of what he describes as an African man.
Yeah. Yeah. Candy, gentlemen, you have my curiosity, but now you have my attention, he said to phrenology. Because again, it made that character, who was based on real people, feel good about the evil things it was doing. And Tarantino, excellent, excellent writer, is very much aware of this. Phrenology is thoroughly debunked. Obviously, if you are rubbing people's skulls, you're not going to learn whether they are good at math or whether they are talented linguistically. But it was so popular across the entire world, not just the US, not just Europe. We're talking about India, Australia, and so on. And Candy, as you said, is definitely based on Charles Caldwell. And you have to wonder what Caldwell would have thought about Django.
Well, I mean, aside from the bloody end, revenge fantasy style of his character and many of his compatriots, I bet he would have been proud of the depiction. You know, I think if he was the same version of himself that he was in those days, I think he probably would have been like, yeah, that was a badass. Because, you know, he brings out that skull, he hacks away at the back of it, he points to the size of a particular region or ridge as being a indicative of submissiveness.
Tameability.
Tameability, another one of those horrible things that we talked about Caldwell himself actually espousing. So this was all real stuff that Tarantino pulled from history to, you know, really flesh out this character. And I think it's a fascinating character, absolutely abhorrent, but really well done and well played by DiCaprio, because you just kind of despise the guy from right. The moment he walks on the scene. But I don't think he's doing anything that Caldwell himself wouldn't have thought was like, yeah, right
100%,
on.
100%, yeah. Me. Also, Caldwell, as a traveler to the modern age, would have been fascinated. We said this in another show. He would have been amazed by the idea of moving pictures. He would have freaked out when he knew you could get cinnamon easily. Anyway, this is the end of our series on phrenology. We hope that you enjoyed it. And as Noel said, we are scratching the surface. There are many, many, many other characters and events in history that are oddly related to this strange, distinct pseudoscience. We can't wait to hear what you think. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks also to our super producer, Noel, you gave him the street name Smoothhead, Mr. Max
Smooth
Williams.
Smooth Skull.
Smooth Skull. Oh, excuse me.
Which actually, if you're a Fallout player, like I know Max is, I think that's what the super mutants refer to humans as. Not smooth skulls, but smooth skins. So it's appropriate there. Max Williams for the win. And huge thanks to Max's bro, the very talented Alex Williams. Long may you wander on your sojourn of this fair country of ours, Alex. Hope you're well, for composing this banging bop.
Thanks also to Christopher Asiotis. Thanks to Eves Jeffcoat. Thanks to our awesome research associate, Zach Williams. Can't wait to have him on the show one day soon. And of course, thanks to avowed phrenologist, Jonathan Strickland, a.k.a. The Quister. Do you think he's going to hear that? I don't think he'll hear it.
We'll see you next time, folks.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.